Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, I'm a programmer at TIFF now, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Teresa Sutherland, whose credits as a screenwriter include Emma Tammy's The Wind and several episodes of Midnight Mass. She made her feature directorial debut last year with Lovely, Dark, and Deep, a slow-burn wilderness thriller about a park ranger, played by Barbarian's Georgina Campbell, trying to find out what happened to her sister, who vanished 20 years earlier in this same park. It's newly available on digital and on demand after a festival run that included stops at Montreal's Fantasia and Toronto's After Dark Film Festival, and you should check it out. Teresa picked Lake Mungo, Joel Anderson's 2008 horror film about an ordinary Australian family struggling with the grief of losing teenage daughter Alice. They're incapable of moving on because they're convinced Alice hasn't moved on either. Presenting as a completely conventional TV documentary and hiding a really disturbing execution of a classic ghost story with an exceptionally complex performance by the young Talia Zucker as the doomed Alice, there's never been a film quite like this. It haunts you, you could say. This is someone else's movie.
I saw Lake Mungo, I think, pretty close to when it came out and in the US on streaming or whatever. It was just like a free movie. I was in film school, like chilling on the couch doing nothing, and saw it. And I was like, all right, I don't know, I'll do this. I'm going to probably have a nap. And then the whole time I was just like, oh my, like, what? Like on the edge of my seat, like the tension and like, the storytelling. And I watched it again last night, but I think it's like 2010 or something. And I am not like Blair Witch got me, Paranormal Activity. I still wasn't completely sure it was all fake. And this, I was just like, is this real? Like, is this real? Oh my God. What is this? Looked it up. Not, but so well done. And just the tension, and it's such a cool ghost story. And there's like themes on time and how time works, and themes on dreams and how dreams work. And it was just like has one jump scare. And I just fucking love that movie.
Yeah. I was just saying before we started recording, it occupies such a weird space in horror because I don't think there's anyone who doesn't love it, who's seen it, but almost no one has seen it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Second Sight released a Blu-ray special edition in the UK, I think 2 years ago. And it's the first, I think it's the first time it's been on, available in high def anywhere. Cause I mean, it's made to look like a cheap DV documentary. So it isn't particularly visually striking, and Lionsgate has never really, they have the rights in the States, but they've never really pushed to do anything with it. And the thing is full of special features, but there's no sign of the director, Joel Anderson. he didn't participate, the writer director. He's just not there. And so this special edition also creates this weird hole in mythology around this mystery object, right? Like this thing, everybody talking about it worked with him, and he seems to be a real person who exists, but there's no, this is the only movie he ever made. He doesn't have a Wikipedia biography. He just did this and wandered off, as far as anyone knows. Banana.
Yeah, I did zero research besides just watching it again to come into this, of course. But that is, like, that adds, I mean, if someone hasn't seen it, they should just go and watch that first. And then, but that adds like a whole nother, like you said, like a whole nother layer to it of being like, wait, is it now? Like, who is this person? What did they do? And I hope it's some sort of just made up name of some really famous Australian director. Just like sitting back and just cackling it at everything.
I mean, now that you mention it, I've been pretty thick into Peter Weir for the last couple of weeks, and this doesn't not feel like something of his.
Have we uncovered something?
Some of his earlier, like his earlier spectral work, the things that we're sort of playing with, things like The Last Wave, that are just on the outside of uncanny, where something is happening, but the film can't quite, the characters in the film can't quite grasp it. This movie is ultimately, that's part of it, right? Like it's about using the format of a conventional documentary to lure the viewer in. Yeah. But it also, it's gotten richer since the true crime thing has happened, right? Like now it actually feels really of a piece with most of the stuff that's floating around on Netflix that you could stumble across this and and fall for it or fall into it, depending.
100%. Like if you knew nothing like me, and when you go in and you watch this, I feel like somebody would want to look it up and Google it and just make sure, just double checking, just making sure of that. Watching it again, I watched it with my husband and we're just on the couch being like, is it the accents that throw like all the radar off of what's acting and what's not for us, or are like, and then the psychic comes up and I'm like, that guy's selling it. That cannot be like, that's not just an accent. That guy is like, he feels like a radio psychic. And I'm like, is he a real radio psychic? Are they just going to people's houses being like, we just like pretend this is happening, use this name instead of that name?
Well, I mean, I do know that the guy who plays a psychic is Steve Jodrell, who is a director of theater and TV and film. But, and this was the thing I didn't know when I saw it, the whole film is improvised. There is no script. There were goals. And Anderson is the guy behind the camera asking questions. And the actors are responding in real time, making up the story to fit what the goal of the scene is. And it's ingenious because it replicates a documentary. It is literally filming real reactions in real time from real people who are pretending.
Yeah.
But as opposed to full improv, right? They're being coached and guided, and there is something in the nervousness of the performers that reads as real. And it's, I mean, I suppose it is real, but as a filmmaker, you can't, as a critic, my brain doesn't go to, well, this is a, you know, like, this is a great performance. Your brain is like, well, these people are asking, they're answering questions. This is real.
Yeah. The pauses, like I was like thinking about the dad and like, he's talking about the porch light being left on. He's like, we left the porch light on. And then he's like, well, why would you do that? Like they know she's dead or whatever. And then the pause he gives and just like such a good pause. And it's like, he's thinking about it and he's just like, in case she wants to come home. And I was just like, Jesus. Like, yeah, no, that makes so much more sense than like, I mean, great acting all around, but also like having that shtick and some of the stuff that just found its way into it, like the driving the car in reverse the night after they identify her body and like it got stuck. They had to get home and then they just show this car going by. And it's just like, that detail means nothing. They absolutely don't need it for this story, but like, it's so random and so weird. And it's just like, because it's so random, it feels so real.
Yeah. But it also sets up the idea of seeing things before they happen and moving in reverse in the way that the characters encounter certain characters. I'm still protecting the movie. The way that Alice encounters time and experiences time.
Yeah.
It's just this, I'd love to know if where that came from. The idea
like,
of it come up.
Improv?
Yeah. Did that just feed kind of into
in?
It?
And the more, like, the more I'm thinking of that improvisation of it all, like, if like so much of, I'm sure they were like, this is the basic outline. Who knows? But this is the basic outline of the story we're telling. And like, this is where we have to get. But like, was that car improv? Because just the way, it's almost like the movie feeds into its own themes. If it is then improv, and it's like, we understand the movie we're making as we're making it, even though there is no script. Yeah. Rabbit holes. Come down a rabbit hole with me. It's what I love to do.
But it's the kind of creation that only happens when everybody believes in something fervently. Like they're all on the same page, but they're also respectful of the format, right? Like there's nobody who's giving a mockumentary performance. Everybody is in it and it's all felt. Like all the emotions are real, even if the structure of the film is sort of almost playful in the way that it sets up what's really going on, that there's that revelation halfway through that, well, okay, a lot of this phenomena has been faked, but confessing one lie while continuing another is a brilliant way to keep the audience off balance and wonder what, you know, like there's still half a movie left. Why are we still watching this if it was phony?
And then in the end, they're like, we all were so concerned with proving there was an afterlife or proving that we missed every single piece of evidence that proved that you were. And I'd never, like, I watched all the credits before, but there was like this post-credit thing at the end on ours that we never made it to. We were just like cleaning up or whatever. And it's just like this really unsettling image that just keeps flickering. And I was just like so terrified, and nothing happened. Like nothing happened. I was like, all day, that was a lot. Just like an image was getting me worked up. And like, that's what this movie does to you. I feel like it just works you up to like this place where somebody could snap their fingers loudly and you jump and scream because you're just like, that's what I'm waiting for. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there's something really marvelous about the way that it refuses to let you go. That every scene is an invitation to look more closely and a question about why you want to. Like, that's the other thing I find so fascinating about the new wave of true crime and what it's supposed to represent. And I think, like everything else, it's narrative. It imposes narrative on chaos and the randomness of life, and that some people die because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Some people die because they're stalked and killed, and I don't want to, you know, devalue that at all. The loss of life is the thing that fixates people, that pulls people in. But I think the illusion of, if you watch enough of these, you know, like the Shaun of the Dead argument, if you see all the zombie movies, then you can find your way through the zombie movie. And it's like, that's not probably healthy. Because it, first of all, on some level, you assign blame to people who fail to follow the rules, right? Like the victims are losers somehow, which is not what Lake Mungo is about. Lake Mungo is about somebody who tries to leave as much of herself behind, knowing that something's coming for her. And opening with that little line of, you know, like, it's coming for me and I don't know when, that's everything. I mean, that's all the things that everyone is trying to avoid in every life.
Yeah.
And to, like, that's the thing that caught me on second and third viewing, I suppose. Whenever I go back to it, it's just like, this is so sad. This is the story of a kid who knows she's never going to grow up and she's just trying to be remembered. And she doesn't know how or why. And then the second and third times you see it, you see the trajectory, right? Like she's on a collision course with this.
Yeah. The first time, well, I don't think I've watched it since becoming a parent, which was 5 years ago. Ooh. And so I was. So like this time I had like a new experience to like mix in with that. And the end where it's showing like two separate sessions with the psychic, and it gives me kind of goosebumps. I'm getting a little teary-eyed, but the one is taking place like at the end of the movie, so Alice is already dead. They've already gone through this whole journey, and it's with the mother, and the mother is talking about going back through her house and how Alice isn't there anymore, and she leaves. And then the other is Alice talking to the same psychic. It's 5 months or something before she's died, and she's talking, but she's doing the same like exercise. So she's in the house and she's in her room, and she's talking about how her mother comes in and she can't see her and she doesn't know she's there, and she leaves. And it just like breaks my heart. Just like broken in half, because on one hand, the mother is alive, absolutely deserves to like live a life that's not just plagued constantly by grief. And on the other hand, like, Alice is there.
Yeah. The thing she most wants is there, and she can't perceive
it. Yeah, she's like right there and she can't perceive it anymore. And like, yeah, it's just like something that's definitely, something has changed in me since seeing it last. And like that part really hit this time. It's like the mother-daughter journey in that.
Oh, no, I get it. I totally get it. Yeah. I mean, we're always different people, right? Like the movie never changes, but we change every time we revisit something. And that's the thing that I think really does fascinate me the most about cinema. It's the only art that's fixed in a way that others can't be. You know, music can be performed live and covered and reinterpreted. Film can be remade, I suppose. But you're always chasing the experience that you had the first time, and you're different. The thing on the wall doesn't change at all, but we keep experiencing things differently. And certainly a movie like this, my God, oh, what it would be like to have that extra level of connection to it.
And as soon as like I started up, I was like, oh, right, this is about her daughter dying. I remember now, this is going to be fun. in my new state of being a mom. But just like there's so much more there now, not just as like a parent, but as like just somebody who has gone through a pandemic and like gone down some deep rabbit holes about time and about like dreams and about like, where are we? What does this mean? Simulation theory, like just like going nuts, just being like, I'm going to figure this out, guys, in 2 years. I'm going to figure it all out. didn't figure it out, but really found some interesting theories out there. And like seeing this movie again, after having like 5 years of just like constant barrage of things. Like picking up on so much more and just see like this movie present things in a new way that probably feel brand new for people who maybe haven't seen it in quite a while too, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly addresses, I mean, what is being stuck at home? What is the afterlife in these movies, if not just being stuck at home forever? And yeah, we can relate now.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, oh, yikes.
Yeah, I saw it on video as well. I think there was some part of my brain tells me it played a film festival in Toronto, but I don't think it actually did. I think maybe there was a theatrical screening after the fact, like a one-off somewhere. But here it was part of this, I think it was one of those 8 films to die for packages that Lionsgate sent out on DVD every year for a while. And it was the one that looked least interesting, weirdly enough. I mean, if you look at the poster, the cover art they came up with for the DVD box, it's a nude woman drowning kind of thing in blue, like a blue light. And it's really not what the movie's about. But they just went for the most shocking, like sort of post Wolf Creek hostile level, like intensity, extreme horror. And again, this is not that in any way. Nope. And yet I don't find a lot. I was looking last night for reviews and trying to find people who hated it, just because someone must have picked it up, assuming it was going to be something totally different. And everything is rapturous. People love it. It shows up on lists of the best jump scares ever, probably because there's only one in the movie.
There's not one.
I don't even know that it is. I mean, the first time it didn't seem that shocking to me. It's unnerving.
It's very unnerving. And I think that they leave you with that image for so long and then they talk a bit about it. And then when they restart it, she like lunges and like the camera,
that's the second part
is like the part that I think is the jumpy part. Not because it's very slow. She just like walks towards this person and you see the face and it's like, and then they freeze on it and you're like, shit.
Yeah.
And then they talk about that for a minute. And then when they restarted, it's like up.
Yeah, it's the clinical way they set it up and then just throw it at you. I'd forgotten about that, the pacing of it. Because it's just now I'm just fascinated by it. When I see it in the film, I look closer. Yeah. Because I mean, it's really clever, it's really unsettling. But not like, I don't know that it's frightening at that point. It's the answer. Right? Yeah. Like that's the thing the thing you've been seeking for this entire movie. And it's weird that a kind of a rote duck, that's the bit where the format starts to almost strain, because you've been watching this really boring true crime documentary, which should start off by saying, hey, ghosts are real. We proved it.
Yeah. Hey, we did that.
Yeah. Because this is
everybody.
It's revolutionary.
Yeah, because after that, they're like, I don't know what that was. And I'm like, dude, you don't know what that was.
Yeah, we do. We know.
We know what that was. They're like, whatever we saw out there, which I guess like, like if you take like a real person and put them in that situation, that may be how they would talk. But like I don't know.
Yeah.
So sorry, I don't know. That just lives in my head forever now, but I don't know what to make of that. So maybe that's it. It just trying to like ground reactions as much as possible. Because it definitely, and I do think that like it's such a good, something I really love about this movie is that it tells you a story and it takes you through that story and it's tense. And if you're like looking for ghosts, like it's that for you. And if you're looking for like kind of just a documentary about a person who's gonna die, like it does that for you. Yeah. Like true crime, paranormal, got it. And it just stretches that out, and all it has to, like, to the point where all it has to do is just like almost what kids in school do or in the 90s, early 2000s would do, which would be like psych, you know, and like right. Do that real quick, and it gets on a list of best jump scares because it has built this tension for an hour that you just don't need anything. You're ready. You're just like, they're going to do something to me. I can feel it. And it just like the little, like, don't have to do it. Doesn't have to be huge. Doesn't have to. And I love that in our genre and in horror. I love that in the storytelling of it. I think that, not to talk about another movie that I didn't have anything to do with, but that Talk To Me kind of new does that too. It's like, here is the story. That's Australian too, right?
It is, yeah.
Man, I'm an Aussie at heart. I love it. Yeah, because it's just like you're watching these kids, and sure, you've got like the hand situation going on, but like, you're just watching them kind of get ready for like what feels like a Saturday night or Friday night. We're just going to go be teenagers and go to this party, which I 100% would have gone to when I was a teenager. Now, right. Probably still, if they were like, we've got this cool hand thing, I'd be like, I'll go.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I'll check it out. but it just like doesn't need to, it doesn't seem like they're following sort of a prescription of horror that has been suggested to me at times as well, which is we got to scare somebody first minute, jump
right,
scare.
Yeah.
10 minutes in, jump scare. 20 minutes in, jump scare. Like, we have to keep this pace up or people are going to get bored and they're not going to like this horror movie. And I just don't think that's true. I think people come to horror movies for a lot of reasons. And I think you'd be much scarier if you just withhold things for quite some time and get a story going.
Oh God, absolutely. I mean, the jump scare the cycle of scares really only started with, I think it was Friday the 13th was the first one. And that's 40 odd years ago, because Sean Cunningham, I love this story because it's so cynical. Sean Cunningham came from porn, like, or from adult, like softcore adult adjacent stuff. And he, or his producer, somebody involved in the film, realized that if you don't kill somebody every 8 minutes, people drift off. Like that's the perfect rhythm. I think, you either start it or you end it every 8 minutes. And that cycle keeps people watching. And it reassures them after it's established that there's more coming. So they stop worrying about it and they give themselves over to the movie. And, you know, it's what, and then that sets up that wonderful joke of Kevin Nealon's on Saturday Night Live years and years ago about porn. It's like, well, I was really excited for 20 minutes and I suddenly lost interest. And then I got excited again. And it's too predictable if you're doing that in a horror film, I find anyway. It's just like, you can start with something big, you know, something like It Follows, where you open with the rules being established in front of you non-narratively. Like we're just taking the exposition in without understanding what's happening. And then 20 minutes later, when that explanation comes along, it's like, oh, okay, I get it. I've seen that.
Yeah. Oh, that's bad. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then once the threat is established, we understand what's going on, but it can have these rhythms of the nature of It Follows. You see it, you run, you see it, you run. There is that sort of rhythm there, but you can play with time and you can play with location, and all those things are orchestrated so beautifully. Talk To Me, the genius of that, I think, is that the kids continue to behave like kids after the first sequence, right? Like they're so relatable and so weirdly stupid teenager-y that it's utterly credible as horror.
And like anybody who's been a teenager or who is a teenager can absolutely relate to this character. Like the whole time you're like, this person seems like they're making all the wrong choices, but like I understand them enough to be like, I see why you're doing that. Like I get that. I like, that makes perfect sense in your head and in mine when I follow your story.
Yeah.
Also makes perfect sense in my head with the other characters, how they're reacting to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the genius of the script, I guess, is that they understand that you can have someone who acts selfishly, but has convinced herself she's doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
And her friends are trying to help her through it, kind of, sort of, just to the point where it all goes out completely out of control. But
yeah.
But it's a slow motion tragedy in a completely different way. And then Lake Mungo is someone who just doesn't have, there's no selfishness to what Alice is going through, which I find so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
She's just making her peace almost.
Yeah. She's just like trying literally anything because she feels like the end is coming. And she does that weird sex tape thing. And her friends are like, I don't know why she'd do that. And then you're like, yeah, cause she what would you do if you felt like that was you're a teenager, an opportunity for okay, doesn't matter. It's not going to ruin my life, sort of thing, if that's how you're feeling. And just talking about it, that's a layer of just being a teenager brings to your life too, is just that this is it for me. This is just life now. And there's who cares? This isn't going to change when, if we're fortunate enough, we do get to change and grow and be different people, really.
Hey, it's Norm interrupting my own show to bring you up to speed on Shiny Things, my newsletter about physical media, culture, and the Odd Streaming Project. Last week, I wrote about the new releases of Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom and the Color Purple musical, and I spun up the Criterion edition of Laura Poitras' All the Beauty and the Bloodshed and found something really special. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at shiny-things.ghost.io or find a link at the Simcast Blue Sky account. You like reading about movies, I like writing about them. Come check it out. When you're a teenager, you think you're indestructible, and what if you're not? Mm-hmm. What if you know you're not?
Yeah.
And it also provides these great, they're organic red herrings to the story, because it's all sensible. That's the wrong word, but it all makes emotional sense in the moment that these things are happening, but that they could also be signs of something else is the tease that's going on underneath, like the pull of a lake, like a whirlpool. You're drawn in further and further to something that's, again, inexplicable but clearly happening. And the editing of the film just is as mundane as possible, so as not to pull you in any further, right? You're not, the film is tricking you by being so basic, and the score is so, it's a combination of the thing that Jason Segel is complaining about in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which is the same year of this. It's just tones, it's just noise, it's tones. But it's really unnerving. Because it just doesn't stop.
No, you will never get chills zooming into a grainy, feels like a grainy VHS image than you do in this movie. They're like, I'm going to zoom in on this grain. And you're like, there's nothing there. And then you're like, whoa, what? Yeah. Also, just thinking of the mundaneness is that shot of the funeral directors. I just, every time they're just funeral director. Both of them, church, and you're just watching a documentary. This is it. This is how you do it.
Yeah, and the use of film formats and video—it's just multiple everything's because it would be. There's no attempt made to make it prettier or sharper or cleaner. I mean, the daylight stuff looks nice, I guess, because the DP in universe is trying, but they're also stuck with what they've got for the archival video, and there's no attempt to. If anything, they've uglied it up. They've probably done their best to make it look distressed and low light and noisy, which is probably the other reason it hasn't come out on high def or anything until now. But I love that. Love that window of time when everything just looked terrible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, all the time. Well, I'll watch an old movie or an old clip of something on YouTube and be like, Do you all believe that we used to sit in front of our TVs and be like, this image is perfect, it's crystal clear, I don't need to see if that guy has a nose or not. Like, it's fine. Like, I know he's got a nose. It's total. This is great. This is perfect. And like thinking now, like, oh, how could we get like 16K? Like, we've done it. And like 10 years from now, we'll look at something and be like,
oh, I know.
16K, Jesus. We were, I can't even see anything that was made in the 90s anymore. My eyes need this clarity.
I am old enough that I used to review Laserdiscs and like VHS. The VHS to Laserdisc leap was enough to be incredible at the time. And I think it was like 370 lines of resolution versus 425 or 460. Maybe it was 325 to 465, but it was noticeable. It was a third at least with the better, but oh my God. Now I look, when we were moving, I found some old magazines that I'd written for and it's just like, oh my God, my fulsome praise of the 4x3 widescreen transfers of things, which now look like, you know, a child should not be allowed to watch them because they won't let their eyes develop.
Exactly. I worked at a video store when DVDs came out.
I was
just like, why? Like, I'm never, trust me to understand the next leap in technology. I will just be like, I don't, like, this will never last. Because I'm pretty sure I said those exact words. I'm just like these things come in scratched all the time. They never play. Garbage. Why would we watch this? This like black thing, I just slam it on this desk and it'll be fine. These tiny little CD things, they're not going to work. And yeah, of course.
Oh, I know. And now we're in a place where like 4K loves film, where you can actually see grain live again. And I'm again, a huge nerd. And I mean, perversely, I would like to see Lake Mungo presented in the highest possible quality just because I want to see what it looked like at the time. I've never seen it projected. And I think
I've never seen it in a theater.
Somehow.
I'm sure. And like the sound in that movie is so fucking quiet. Like just like, they were like, bring it down. They need to crank that all the way up and gradually we'll get louder. And so they just don't notice. Like, I'm almost paused. Like, that has to be purposeful because at the beginning, they're like, and then like by the end they're like
it's existential screaming.
But yeah, I remember just like cranking it, and now I have to be conscious of that because I only get to enjoy my horror movies after 7-8 p.m.
right,
when little ones are in bed. But I would just like started it really high this time and just like every 10 minutes I just take it down and not to be like, we still hear it, it's fine.
Which is a great way to unnerve an audience though, right? I mean, to just sort of creep up on them on a level that isn't detectable immediately, though, in a way you can't understand while you're in it.
It's so smart and creative and gets people to lean in. And once you have them as like a horror filmmaker, like once you have your audience like forward, they're not gonna lean back until they're scared. And that's like the only time they're gonna kind of do that, which is just precious. Like, that's what you want. You always want people to like lean in, that way you have the ability to force them back. I love my genre. I love it. Just the way it affects like the physiology of people and like thinking of how to do that in new ways and different ways. And like Mungo is just like, it's a masterclass of just like, let's like, storytelling is awesome. You can creep people the fuck out in storytelling. You don't need all of this. Here's a jump scare. That was great. Here's some sound design. Listen to this. Like, here's how you do a camera in this situation. Like, it all feels like it's so real and it's something that Dateline did. And just like, you're just watching this documentary and so chilling and so well put together like that.
Well, and it also plays on, it's funny, you when you say you're an Australian at heart, it's something that the terror of landscape, the terror of open space, which is something that's at work. I guess there's the contrast in Lake Mungo of people going to their death outdoors but living trapped forever inside, which is a a part of Haunting that doesn't make sense exactly, but the film comes up with the analogy so beautifully when it just has Alice say, I'm in my room and my mother can't see me. It's like, it's what she wants is to be there. Even if she doesn't understand what that means, some part of her is drawn back, even though she didn't die at home. The work you've done is, it's not terrified of the outdoors, but it's the wind, the screenplay for The Wind and certainly Lovely, Dark and Deep are movies about people trapped alone with themselves in vast spaces. And I was just kind of wondering if that's something that Lake Mungo pulled on for you at the time.
Probably. I think that I've always been like, there was this series called Scariest Places on Earth.
Okay.
And what is that? 13 Nights of Halloween, like 2002. Okay. I'll date it there. The Halloween special thing, and they just like went around and it was very documentary, but it was telling these like real stories. And I couldn't go to the bathroom by myself. There's something about making it feel real and so grounded and in places or situations that you relate to but don't really relate certain kinds of horror or being scared with. In Lovely, Dark and Deep, we tried to do a lot in the daytime. That's not really a time while you're watching a horror movie that you're going to expect something to come. That's usually our safe time,
right,
as an audience. But we cannot shoot a whole movie in the daytime with our budget or at the nighttime with our budget. So you like pushing to make more scares happen in the daytime, pushing that intensity during the daytime. I think like dragging out tension is something I really love. And Lake Mungo does that so well, just like making you sit with this unnerving thing. And what is that doing to these people? And being trapped in your mind is the scariest haunted house. And wide open spaces are terrifying too. you don't need like four walls to trap you. You can be trapped anywhere. Yay. Everywhere's scary. In writing and directing and just like creatively being in the horror genre, that's constantly something I'm looking for, is a place that we haven't seen this type of story happen in, and how would that affect this type of story? One of my screenwriting teachers long ago said, like, the most important piece of writing advice I've ever had, and it's something that's just stuck with me, which is, if you're going to tell a story, you have two options. You can tell a story that narratively nobody's ever heard before, and you can set it in a very familiar location, or you can find a story that people have heard and set in a location that it's never been told before. And like those are the options I always look for. Those are my two options. Like, I can tell your most basic haunted house story if I set it on a spaceship in space. Like, that's new. We're gonna have new things happen. Doesn't matter that you've heard that horror story, because of the environment, it will absolutely be changed. Or like, you can come up with like the brand new haunted house story and set in a house, that's the hardest for me. Just like, a brand new story to set in the house. But I guess in a sense, like, The Wind is a Western set in the horror genre. Mm-hmm. Like, Lovely, Dark and Deep is something new in the woods. Like, that's set in our national parks.
I was trying to figure out how to describe it, where it fits. And it's it's survival horror in a way, but not really, because that implies a certain narrative arc, and that's not what you're doing. And I hesitate to go too close to the story on this one, because people should discover it for themselves, but it really is offering a new challenge, I think, narratively to what the genre usually demands of people.
I'm obsessed with, like, my favorite types of stories are mysteries and ghost stories. And like, I will always try and throw paranormal in something, for like, we're going to figure something out together, guys. Here's a mystery. We got to solve it. I think all my favorite horror movies are all mysteries. They're the best mysteries. And then, yeah, just like follow through that sort of train of thought with this character and just kind of see where we go. Like, here's what's happening. Here's this. Hi, I'm Tracy. You're Lennon. You're new. Let's go in through your story. And like, we'll find out what happens together. Surprise for everybody.
And that is how it went. I mean, did you have the ending in mind when you started, or did you just really start blind?
I that's my favorite way to write. I don't outline. I don't do treatments. I hate doing that. I'm on a project. It's a TV project. And just at the point of my career where I'm like, I'm just going to do what I want to do. And they're like, okay, here's your contract. Like, they want an outline. And I was like, well, I already wrote the first episode. Can that be the outline? And they're like, what? Like, the BA is confused. Everybody, I'm like, just call it the outline. Bonus, you get this, and we get to start from a place we can actually work from, instead of me trying to figure out this whole story with this person in a weird format that's not my format. Mm-hmm. And trying to retrofit that to be this. Like, if I get to write like this, I get to find surprises for myself. I get to find things, and I'm having fun. And isn't that what you want your writer to do? Like, have a great time, and you get a script out of it. Bonus. So that's sort of how I write. I feel like all of the I just basically went to school, learned how to write screenplays, and I was like, not gonna do it that way. Thank you, though. I'll figure out how to pay back another time. I'm going to do it this way and see how that works. And I think that a lot of what's taught in writing, I feel like there are definitely like, it's gatekeeping. Like, it's just like, hey, you need to write this way. This is how we do it as professionals. This is how you tell a proper story. And if you can't tell it this way, you're probably not a writer. And I think that's completely incorrect. I think humans are storytellers. From being a child, you know, a middle, beginning, middle, and end. Those are your act structures. Who cares? Like, call them what you want. But like, you know how to tell a story and put it together. And putting all of these, like, we need a treatment or an outline or whatever. If that works for you, fantastic. I love that for you. But if it does not work for you, it doesn't mean you're a bad writer or you're not a writer. Just like, dig in and write the way that makes you happy if you've got a story to tell. And my favorite writing book is On Writing by Stephen King, because he basically said that. And that was like the first time I was ever validated and felt like, oh, okay. Whew, I'm good. Like, this is fine. I'm okay. This is fine. I felt like I wasn't wrong and how I wanted to tell stories. And I think that's really important for people to feel. And we need more people with whose brains work different ways, who are from different places, who can do things in different ways to get new stories and fresh stories and scarier stories. And that's what excites me the most, is like, once we break through this like idea that only certain people can write or only this can happen or whatever, like, we're gonna get the most awesome fucking horror movies. and that's what I want.
Oh, I'm on board. I've never understood. I mean, I can see it structurally if you're doing a mystery or you're doing something that where the genre has strict requirements, but even then you have to be allowed to play. But the idea of beat sheets and outlining everything and knowing exactly what's going to happen before you've written the story seems self-limiting somehow, like stifling. I love movies where clearly they started with the premise or the situation and then built the world around that or found the right character. There's a story about adapting The Boys for Amazon, where it was one of the showrunners just realized that the way to make it work is to introduce a character much, much earlier and start a relationship between the two leads seasons ahead of where it would have been had they followed the arcs of the comics. And they said it was simply that this guy sat down on a bench and this character came up, and that's how it happened on the page. That's when they were writing. It's like, well, this is what we have to do. And that's an adaptation of existing material that cracks the thing in half and finds the heart of it. And yeah. It's a weird example because The Boys isn't horror, but it is like that sort of it's superhero narrative, which is now its own subgenre, like codified in stone, where you have things 100%. Have to happen at a certain time. And in horror, it's things like, it's like Talk to Me, where we're just going to a party. What's at the party? Oh, I haven't written that yet.
Yeah, I don't know. These kids are like, and the way they introduce in Talk to Me, the mother's death. It's not like, I feel like, and another movie, it might have been like Funeral. That's where we're going to start. Right. Everybody's sad. Her mother's definitely dead and she might have killed herself. Let's continue on. Jump scare. it's just like that. Instead, they're like, you'll figure it out.
Yeah.
We'll get there. We'll talk about it. But like, these people don't need to talk about it because they know what's going on. And I think that's such an important part of storytelling is like, what do your characters know? They're not going to talk about that like they don't know it. They're going to talk normally, and it'll be up to you as the writer and the audience to sort of piece that together, and that's mystery, and that's a great thing to have. Like, there nobody should be afraid of that in any genre, but especially in horror. Like, you should not be afraid to not scream things up front, because that is mystery and that is awesome, and we as humans love to figure shit out. Love it. Like, think about Game of Thrones. How many conversations did you have where you were like, this is going to happen and this is, oh my God, this is going to happen. We're going to find out tonight. Like, of course, none of us got what we wanted to happen. But like, maybe somebody did, but maybe somebody predicted it. But like that, like True Detective. Like,
yeah. Oh God, I remember all, the online theories about, like, True Detective and the Yellow King and all of that stuff. And none of it mattered to the show.
None of it mattered. But that's fun. That's something we love to do as people. And like, I just don't think storytellers should be afraid to like let something live as a mystery for a minute, because our brains have already, like, they're watching the movie, they're trying to figure that out. What happened? Oh, maybe they're having a conversation if they're at home or whatever, or in a movie theater. But it's how I love stories. That's how I love to tell stories. Like, start from your character, let your character figure it out. You're there to help them, take them on this journey. When I started writing Lovely, Dark, and Deep, it was, I was very pregnant, very sick, and kind of just like stuck in bed. And I had known that my next screenplay was going to be about like this national parks missing. I freaked me out, loved the concept, really wanted to play with it. And I also had always been fascinated with backcountry rangers. I think that's such an interesting job to be like, yeah, sure, I'll just go like in the middle of nowhere where nobody knows anything and hang out for 3 months. I'm good. That's me. I love that. And like, if you want to isolate a character and get him away from like cell phones, what a great place, what a great way to do that. So like, just build, and then Lennon became like our main character, and like, I knew that she had a past with this park because somebody in her family had gone missing, and just like going with her on this journey in this place. I did a lot of reading about national park rangers, lots of autobiographies, lots of just like books written about other rangers and things that had happened, and just like let that inform this person, and tried to make her feel as grounded and real as possible so that I could get fucking weird. Cause I figured that's where we were going. I'm pretty good at just like finding the weirdest possible path, because you don't want to do the thing that everybody is expecting. And so you're shifting and moving and being like, well, if we go down that road, people might really like it, but like, they've seen it, they can watch that movie. If we go down this road, that's something different. Let's see what happens. And so, yeah, that's my ridiculous, weird process of writing. Just to make everybody feel safe about their own processes of writing. You can be as out there as you want to be.
Yeah. I mean, you get where the movie, how can I phrase this? The movie gets where it needs to go because of that, I think, because you just let it rip and see where you end up. You've, now you have this thing that's unlike all the other outdoor things.
Yeah. And some people will love it. Some people will not like it. They'll be like, I don't understand what's going on. A few people have been like, they over explain things. And I'm like, oh, that's an interesting, I've never gotten that before. Thank you so much. What a new critique. I love that.
That's not something I would necessarily have said about it.
No, but happy to have it.
Sure. Breadth of experience.
Yeah. Always looking for that. Some people will be like, this is cool. And maybe it sparks something else for them. And that gets it pushed farther. Same way I felt about the wind. Like, you like it, you don't like it. It is something that we don't see a lot. We haven't seen in a long time. They did like, we will always be on a list of the best horror westerns for sure. If they make them, because there are like five and you have to have at least five, I think, for a list. I'm bringing it back to like Mungo. I think it's that kind of like that confident storytelling, that storytelling where like this story is interesting and I'm going to get you. Like, don't worry. I'll get you. This story is interesting though. That I love. And I think blended with like just spending, just like craving that as a teen and early adult, with that sort of like paranormal documentary, all of those shows that came up, I was a fan of in college. There was like a show called Stranded that I'm like, was awesome. We like sci-fi went through like a whole thing. I'm sure that they're gone now. Those were my Amazon purchases in college were the seasons of that. those weird paranormal ghost hunting shows that I was like, what's going to happen? Are we going to find something?
Yeah.
And now none of it's real.
No, it was never real. If it was, if it was real, it's that feeling. It's like the movies about Bigfoot and, you know, in the 70s, the stuff I grew up on, the TV commercials for the mysterious monsters, which looked as distressing as possible. And it's like, these early reenactments, they were unconvincing at the time. It's like, if this is real, why isn't it on the news? Like,
yeah, this would be in the news.
Inherently flawed.
And now stuff gets on the news and we're like, that's not real. Yeah, like,
that's a good point.
Aliens were like, no, you guys have done this before. We've seen this on TV.
Yeah, it's just light off a car bumper. You're not fooling anybody.
Yeah. You work for the government. Like, I'm going to trust you.
God. That's where we are now.
Yep. It's all come full circle. So excited to see the next start of whatever circle.
My thanks to Teresa Sutherland, whose eerie new thriller, Lovely, Dark, and Deep, is now available on digital and on demand from XYZ Films. Thanks also to Christian Burgess. He knows what he did. You can find Teresa on Instagram at Terry Sue Loves You, all one word. TerrisueLovesyou. And you can find Lake Mungo on DVD from Lionsgate Home Entertainment. If you're in the UK, there's that special edition Blu-ray from Second Sight. It's also streaming on Vudu, Tubi, and the Roku channel in the US, and available to rent and buy on various VOD services. You can find me on Blue Sky at Norm Wilner, and you can find this podcast there at Simcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. The first year of the show is still available for just $20 at payhip.com/Simcast. That's the first 52 episodes of Someone Else's Movie, 44 of which aren't currently available anywhere else. And check out my newsletter, Shiny Things, at shiny-things.ghost.io. I think you'll enjoy it. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review wherever you've been listening. Every little bit helps. It truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network while you're doing that. Stay safe, watch movies, wear a mask if you go out, get the new booster when you can. I'll see you next week.